Welcome to Gravity, a podcast on the environment and human rights issues from the local to the global. Since the rather inaptly named Taliban, which means students in Pashto, took over Afghanistan again in August 2021, they have instituted a system which intentionally and systemically persecutes, dominates, and oppresses women. Which should have come as no surprise, as this is what they did the first time round. Women in Afghanistan cannot obtain more than an elementary education. They're denied work in numerous professions, cannot participate in government, are banned from parks and other public spaces, and cannot show any part of their face, body, or God forbid the vice of their voice in public. The Taliban want women to be walking sarcophagi encased in sartorial walls. The ICC has rightfully issued warrants for the arch-criminals Hibatullah Akhundzada and Abdul Hakim Haqqani for their crimes against humanity. In Iran, women have also been systemically oppressed. Women are under male guardianship all their lives. Husbands can deny women the right to work or work in a particular profession and control their wives' travel. And women lose custody of their children in divorce. In the courts, women's testimony is worth half of a man's. And girls attain criminal responsibility at 9, but boys not till 15. And this is but a sliver of discriminatory and oppressive laws designed to deny women equal dignity and opportunity. The Islamic regime fortified hijab laws in September 2024 for all females 12 and over by increasing fines and prison terms and even allowing for the death penalty. But the women of Iran have been steadfastly resisting for years, including taking photos of themselves in public without wearing hijab and burning their hijab. After the brutal beating and murder of Jina Mahsa Amini in police custody for not wearing her hijab properly in September 2022, there were widespread protests by women and men. These protests continued. Now there are daily and widespread protests. Women's oppression is not the only concern. There are water shortages, a collapsing economy, resistance to Iran's foreign policy. But together, men and women are resisting the theocratic regime. Yet, there is a concerning normalization of these apartheid regimes, including people taking tourist trips to Afghanistan and commenting on its stunning landscape, but also its cultural authenticity. Are we to adhere to what the criminals oppressing the people of Afghanistan consider Afghan culture to be when this is the country that gave women the vote in 1919 and made their education mandatory in 1920? We need to be wary of arguments based on cultural relativism. Culture is not static, it's dynamic and shaped by structures of power and resistance. Domination of women is not culture, nor can anyone claim a religious right to persecute women. For rights can only be recognized within the universality of human rights. That means, in plain and simple terms, sex and gender equality. Yet there are numerous states in the world where women are under male guardianship, including Afghanistan, Iran, and Saudi Arabia. That is not culture. That is not religion. That's bullshit. The world does not accept any cultural or religious right to institute apartheid on the basis of race. So why do we accept it on the basis of gender? Activists from Afghanistan and Iran want to establish gender apartheid as a crime against humanity, and we should. Gender apartheid is defined as inhumane acts committed in the context of an institutionalized regime of systemic oppression and domination by one gender group over another gender group or groups and committed with the intention of maintaining that regime. That is what is happening in Afghanistan and Iran, and our silence is our complicity. Not only does our complicity entrench their oppression, but oppression begets oppression. Regimes that oppress women oppress LGBTQ persons. Men, forced to be the foot soldiers of the oppressive regime, are likewise oppressed. Women's rights are backsliding around the world. Women predominantly face particularized gendered form of violence and assault, from acid attacks to digital violence, including from deepfakes and privacy incursions. Not even a sitting leader is immune. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum was assaulted on the street. We need to be vigilant and stand together globally and at home. It's simply insupportable that we have still failed to pass the Equal Rights Amendment and allowed numerous states to have legislated strict abortion laws that are in fact religious edicts and hence violate the anti-establishment clause of the First Amendment. Not to mention there's a fringe movement that women's place is in the home. Well, that's plain and simple bullshit. Women's rights are human rights, and we must uphold them everywhere. I spoke to Heather Barr, a human rights lawyer and the Associate Women's Rights Director of Human Rights Watch, in November on these issues and more. Welcome to Gravity FM, Heather.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
It is my pleasure. So since August 15, 2021, the Taliban, I'm having a lot of trouble calling them the Taliban because I know in Pashto it means students, and I really don't think they've learned anything from Taliban 1.0 to Taliban 2.0. It's still the same cruel, inhumane practices. So I'm going to call them the criminals because I really think that that's what they deserve. So these criminals, they've come in. You remember the ghastly pictures of people even holding on to the wheels of a plane to get out because they knew what was happening. There is systemic oppression against women. Women can't go to school apart from sixth grade. They have to wear these sartorial walls when they go outside. They can't laugh in public. I think there's over 100 edicts. Can you please explain all these edicts that control women?
Yeah, it's hard to know where to start, honestly, but maybe I'll start by saying that when there were negotiations going on between the United States and the Taliban over the U.S. withdrawal, the Taliban said, you know, they were asked many times about what their attitude was about women's rights, and they just completely lied. They said, no, you know, women will be equal, women can study, women can have any job. They really made it sound like they had completely turned over a new leaf. And then, as you said, after they took over the country on August 15th, 2021, and they held a press conference, actually, I think about 2 days after they took over. And at that press conference, they said the same thing. Women and men are equal, it'll be equal rights, don't worry. But I think it was the next day that they started cracking down. I think one of the first things they did was they banned women from being on the state television station. Within a few weeks, they had banned girls from going to secondary school. And those different bans, those different orders have continued one after another, after another, after another. And that's still happening now. So even today, a colleague of mine was writing a piece about how there's a new rule in Herat, which is in the western part of Afghanistan, where women can't go into a hospital to get medical care if they aren't wearing a burqa. And she's written about how a doctor who's a surgeon at that hospital was stopped from going to her place of work and detained because she was accused of not wearing a burqa. But I don't want to focus too much on the clothing aspect of it, because honestly, that's not what women, I think, are most troubled by. It's freedom of movement, it's access to paid employment, it's access to education, it's access to healthcare, and it's just human dignity. They've adopted rules like women's voices shouldn't be heard in public, women shouldn't sing. It's really like every aspect of women's lives, from most fundamental to some of the things that just make you feel human, like singing or playing a sport or something like that. A lot of Afghan women describe it as if their homes have become their prisons because there's so little freedom for them to move around and to leave the house and to be part of public life.
Right. Now, if women can only go to school until grade six, and if women can only be treated by women, how are women ever going to get healthcare if the current doctors stop practicing? There can be no female doctors, right? And how are men going to get healthcare considering that they all start out in women's wombs, right? And how is this going to play out exactly? What is the grand plan?
They didn't immediately ban medical education for women, but they did eventually ban medical education. I think that happened in December of last year. Mm-hmm. And so the impact of that is exactly what you would imagine. if women can't be treated by male doctors and women can't train to become doctors, then over time you increasingly have a situation where there are no doctors for women, or nurses or midwives or, you know, other types of healthcare professionals. And that process is happening right now by banning secondary education for girls. You already had a situation where how could you move on to study to become a midwife or a nurse or a doctor if you weren't able to complete high school? And then they sort of took one step further by formally banning medical education. So I think, you know, it's perfectly clear that, you know, they're willing to have women die in furtherance of this vision that they have for what they think society should be like.
And so when you systemically oppress and dehumanize, what, 50% of your population, you necessarily dehumanize everybody, because then even men that resist this oppression, now they're tied to it because they get punished if they support their daughters, right? And their sisters and their wives and their friends, no?
Yeah, so this is one of the things the Taliban have done, is that they did this fairly early on where they announced that if women were, misbehaving somehow, if they were not dressed in the way that the Taliban thought they should be dressed, if they were out and about without a male relative chaperoning them, they would punish not the woman, but her male relative. And so essentially they were coercing men into becoming the jailers of their female relatives. Yeah, so, I mean, this is deeply harmful to the entire society, not just to women. And we've seen some men resisting. There are men who've gone to prison and been tortured sometimes for their efforts to stand up for women's rights in Afghanistan. I think that's happened to far more women than men, but there have been some male allies, because there are men that see that this isn't a society which is a decent place for anyone.
No, and when we talk about oppression and discrimination against women, we're really talking about gender discrimination, which means the LGBTQ community can't be safe either, right?
No, absolutely. I mean, we published a report that came out, I think, in January 2022 about what the situation was for LGBT people under the Taliban. And what we found when we interviewed people is that people's lives had been incredibly hard prior to the Taliban takeover. That, you know, it's in no way was, you know, pre-August 2021 Afghanistan a welcoming or safe place for LGBT people, but that any sort of tiny bit of safety that that they had vanished completely when the Taliban came and took over. I one of the men that we interviewed, he said to me something like, before the takeover, like, no one could murder me. You know, that he might be harassed, he'd be discriminated against at work, he might be beaten up by the police, he might be sexually assaulted by the police, but that no one would murder him because they would face some kind of consequences if they did that. And after the Taliban takeover, I think even that tiny, tiny bit of feeling safer was gone.
I'd like to discuss the systemic oppression of women and LGBTQ people in Iran as well, because so before 1979, when you had a leftist revolution that actually women participated in because it was against the corrupt Shah. And so both women and men thought that they would have a more progressive society by and large. And instead, what you got was compulsory hijab laws, and women losing custody of their children in divorce and segregation and other things. They have morality clinics if you don't wear your hijab. They beat you up if you don't wear hijab. They arrest you. They can kill you.
So I've never been to Iran and I've never worked on Iran. So I'm not an expert on the situation there by any means at all. But of course, perhaps like you and like many women around the world, I've sort of watched the women life freedom movement and admired the courage of of the women who've risked so much to protest in that effort. And I guess the one thing I would say about it, which I think is something in common with Afghanistan too, is that the issues about the hijab are one visible aspect of oppression and things that women are resisting about, but it's often not the most important issue at all. Like, the more important issues are things like discriminatory family laws and
right
barriers to economic participation and alarming rates of child marriage at really terrifyingly young ages sometimes, and lack of protections against gender-based violence, things like that. So I think that sometimes there's a kind of an overemphasis on issues about dress and hijab, and whereas the problems are much more complicated and much deeper. And when you see people, when you see women and men, I think it's been exciting to see how many men have been part of the protests in Iran. I've definitely heard Afghan friends say, why aren't there more Afghan men coming out in the way that Iranian men have? I think you really, I mean, it's interesting. Part of what you really see is that women are leading the resistance to oppression in both countries. These are women-led resistance movements in both Iran and Afghanistan.
Yeah, and men have been participating in Iran. Yes, I've been reading that men are participating and helping women. They're even mixing. Actually, one of my yoga teachers went to Iran and taught a mixed yoga class. And men are participating in that. And that's what we really want to see, men supporting women. The women of Iran have not given up, and it is very admirable. But that's the thing, right? Like, when you're looking at these countries in silos, I don't think we can do that, because what's happening to women around the world affects us. There's a ripple effect, right? Why are countries normalizing the Taliban instead of calling them out as the criminals that they are? Why are we sending male delegations to meet the Taliban to appease their criminal animus? It seems that is actually threatening our rights as well.
Yeah. Women's rights has never been much of a priority in foreign policy for most countries. So if there are security cooperation options available to them, if there are trade deals to be made, and male diplomats usually representing these countries, male foreign ministers making decisions, you're not going to see countries sacrificing sort of things that they think are in their financial or political interest for women's rights for the most part. I mean, the movement toward feminist foreign policy has been an effort to kind of redraw that map in some countries. And there actually was a meeting in Paris just a couple of weeks ago about feminist foreign policy that convened all of the countries that have made this commitment to have a feminist foreign policy. But, it's a really challenging moment for that idea, for that strategy. UN Women said in March of this year that one out of every four countries is experiencing some kind of backlash against women's rights. So we really are sort of in what feels like an escalating global backlash against women's rights that we're seeing in many, many countries around the world. And so it's interesting. You think about things like the Sustainable Development Goals and the kind of optimism that people had when they were making those goals like ending child marriage globally by the year 2030. And, that I think that seemed very ambitious when that goal was created, but now it seems, sort of unthinkable, because we're in this posture now where we're trying to not lose the gains that we already had. And the idea of sort of making further progress, of course we have to try and we have to fight for it, but it feels much harder than it did even a couple of years ago.
Unfortunately, I agree with you. I do see that women's rights are backsliding everywhere. I think earlier in the year, Iraq lowered the marriageable age of a woman to 9 I don't even know why I'm saying woman. That's a child. 9. I mean, that's, I don't even have words for that. But just going back to Afghanistan, though, and Iran and the wider systemic oppression, the whole society basically geared towards oppressing one group, which is women. We've heard the term apartheid. It's an Afrikaans term meaning separation, but it was the de jure government policy of South Africa. And what led to its eventual downfall was really international opprobrium, sanctions, sustained effort over decades. And when we think of apartheid, we think of South Africa, but it's not the only country that had apartheid. The American South had Jim Crow laws, which actually the Nazis looked to when they made the Nuremberg laws. So we've had apartheid. We have apartheid in the Palestinian occupied territories. So it's not the only country that instituted it. But if we read from the 1976 Apartheid Convention and in the Rome Statute, the crime against humanity, it seems to me that if you just take out the racial aspect, this is what women are experiencing in Afghanistan. Seems to me obvious. Here we go. It is inhuman acts committed for the purpose of establishing and maintaining domination by one racial group of persons over any other racial group or persons and systemically oppressing them and committed with the intention of maintaining that regime. Take out race. Is this what we have in Afghanistan and Iran?
So the Taliban were first in power from 1996 to 2001 in Afghanistan. And during that, there's a growing movement to not only use that term, but to make that term have legal meaning. And there's a really interesting and important law professor. Her name's Karima Banoon. She's a professor at University of Michigan in the United States. She's the former UN Special Rapporteur on Culture. And she wrote a really important law review article that was published in late 2022, which sort of laid out what it would mean if the term gender apartheid had legal meaning as opposed to just descriptive meaning. And that article, along with the activism of Afghan women who, you know, had started using this term back in the 90s, has really led to this very powerful movement to try to actually make gender apartheid a crime under international law. And there's an opportunity to make that happen because, fortuitously, I guess, the United Nations is in the process right now of considering a new treaty on crimes against humanity. There was a decision in December of last year to move forward with a negotiation process to develop this treaty. And there's a draft of the treaty already that was prepared by the UN. And in that draft treaty, the crime of apartheid is already there. But the crime the definition that they've used in the draft treaty is the definition from the Rome Statute. So it has that language that you've read out about race. And it limits the crime to acts committed on the basis of race. And so what these activists, and it's, I should say, it's activists from Afghanistan and Iran who are really leading this effort. What they are demanding is that definition be changed to say race or gender. So to add it in so that gender can also be the basis for finding that the crime of apartheid has been committed. And, you know, processes to adopt a new treaty are not fast. This process is planned to take up until 2029. And so there's a lot of time between now and the end, you know, for advocacy, for more states to get on board. But it's been encouraging that there are already about 10 states that have expressed at least an openness to including this crime, to adding gender apartheid to the treaty. And I think it's it's really important, and it's really a testament to the power of the activism of these women from both countries. One of the questions that people ask sometimes about this is they say, well, yes, but Taliban abuses and abuses in Iran are happening right now. You know, you're talking about a process that's going to take until 2029. Like, what good is that going to do a girl who can't go to school today? And, you know, the answer to that question, I mean, I don't want to be sort of overly rosy about things. I mean, the answer, it's not going to do anything for a girl who's not able to go to school today. But I do think that this conversation about changing this treaty, making this an international crime, is one of our best hopes for slowing down this process of normalization that you talked about, of making countries think twice before they invite the Taliban foreign minister to walk a red carpet in their capital, or they consider reopening their embassy in Kabul, or they consider making a trade deal and having smiling photographs, shaking hands with the Taliban. So I think, because one of the things about the crime of apartheid is that it also raises questions about who's complicit in that apartheid, who are the perpetrators, but also who's complicit. And so I think it puts some pressure on other countries not to be complicit.
Yeah, yeah. That's what happened with South Africa, right? It was an international movement. And there is a movement, but it seems to be lacking in vitality as it was against the South African regime. I've read that there is some opposition because to add gender apartheid internationally, because it would dilute apartheid, the racial apartheid, but I don't see how that is possible. Gender is half the we have half the population, and we could use gender apartheid when people are systemically trying to oppress, persecute, and destroy the LGBTQ community, right? Because that would come under gender as well. So I do think that it is time to change, because it won't dilute. It would actually enforce that the international community will no longer accept such heinous oppression.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say two things in response. One is that, and I've had the great fortune to sit in some rooms where there have been Afghan activists and South African activists talking to each other. And one of the things that one of the South African experts said that I'll always remember is she said, look, it took 30 years to overthrow apartheid. There was nothing fast about that struggle. The Taliban came back to power in Afghanistan a bit more than 4 years ago. That's been an intolerable 4 years for women and girls in Afghanistan. They're suffering every single day. But you know, this is going to take time. If we're looking to international law and international pressure to change the situation, this may be a long-term project. But that doesn't mean that it won't ultimately be successful, and that it isn't worth the time and the effort. I think another thing about it is that it's been a powerful kind of movement building tool. I think it's really been an advocacy strategy that's mobilized a lot of Afghan women. The UN does periodic surveys of women inside of Afghanistan. They did a survey, I think it was maybe about a year ago, or maybe a bit longer, but where they asked, I think they did a survey about 2,500 women across most of the different provinces of Afghanistan. And they asked them what they thought about this term, what they thought about the term gender apartheid. And the majority of the women they surveyed said that they thought that did describe what they were experiencing, and that they did want the United Nations to use that term in describing Taliban abuses against women and girls in Afghanistan. So it's really resonating with them, obviously. And I think that another thing to say about this that's important is if they succeed, if Afghan and Iranian women succeed in getting this treaty changed and the treaty gets adopted, and once the treaty's adopted, gender apartheid is an international crime, that creates a new set of protections for every woman on the planet. So for you, for me, for everyone else. And it's really, really powerful to think about you know, them taking these experiences of abuse that they're facing and turning that into change that provides all of us with greater protections. And so I think that we all have an obligation to stand with them because they're standing with us, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. When we stay silent, it impacts us as well. We can see even in the US, we have been losing rights. The Dobbs decision held that abortion was not constitutionally protected. And then we have a slate of laws around the country, some that are just so heinous, that say conception begins at birth. And actually, I think they're unconstitutional. I really do, because under the First Amendment, we have an anti-establishment clause, and there is no medical reason that conception should begin at birth, for instance. And even in the preamble, the representatives that are making these laws state their religious beliefs. So it seems to me that we actually have religious edicts in this country now, and that is against our constitution. It is also really limiting women's choices, women's health care. Women have died. They have bled out because of these horrible laws. And even in places like California, there was a Catholic hospital that nearly killed a woman. She nearly bled to death because they refused to treat her, and she had to drive herself while she was bleeding to death to another hospital. This is just cruel.
No, I mean, absolutely. I mean, this, this backlash that we're talking about against women's rights is coming out in all sorts of ways, you know? And certainly the attack on reproductive rights is a major one. And the US is a particularly bad example, but this is happening in many other countries as well, you know? One of the other issues that the team that I'm part of has been working on a lot is the issue of obstetric violence, which is also a part of what you're describing, you know, when people face abuse while giving birth or denied care and in ways that are often, you know, sort of along racial lines. And so, yeah, I have colleagues who've been documenting that in various countries around the world.
Yeah, and this is a way to control women, right? If you don't have a reproductive choice, if you don't have proper health care, you are vulnerable. I can't think of any example for men that have to deal with any of this. And the thing is, they don't want to stop here. And this conservative agenda is quite frightening, this religious movement. They intend to erode the right of contraception and accessibility completely. They want to get rid of no-fault divorce. Okay, so that's wonderful. Just keep women in abused marriages. And there's even, now, I nearly wanted to scream when I read this, but I think that maybe, tell me that I'm just being crazy, but is there a fringe movement that wants to repeal the 19th Amendment and it's just a household right? I mean, I know this is a fringe movement, right? But are we in 2025 in the US talking about women not voting?
I think if I recall exactly what happened, I think that there was a guy, an American minister or preacher or someone who was talking on social media about how he thought that families should vote, like, you know, as one unit, not individuals voting. And the implication, even if he didn't, I can't recall if he said it explicitly or not, of course, was that the male head of the household would decide how that family was going to vote, which effectively would mean that women were no longer able to vote. And I think something happened where Pete Hegseth, who's the Secretary of War, I believe his title is now, retweeted it and then had to, or liked it or something, and then had to, like, sort of issue a statement clarifying that he was not opposing women's voting.
Though he liked that video.
Something like that, if I'm recalling correctly.
Yeah, interesting. Okay. Maybe he just doesn't understand what thumbs up means, you know, could be that. Secretary of War. So actually, that brings us again back to our point that we're not that different, right? If some people have this religious view that women shouldn't vote or households should vote, and therefore they imagine a household to be a woman and a man, and the man is the head of the household, well, it's a really slippery slope to when you have male guardianship, right? And that brings me to cultural relativism. I find that quite dangerous as a theory. To me, culture is not static, it's dynamic, and it is generally the expression of power dynamics within a particular society. And I am very much an advocate of a quote attributed to Mahatma Gandhi, that we should swim and not sink in the waters of tradition. And many times when people talk about cultural rights or religious rights, it's really an incursion on women. Because every religion out there, I don't know any religion where women are controlling men. Maybe I should start one. Who knows? I'm not going to. I'm just kidding. And maybe that is just a silly fear of mine, but I am concerned.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my response to that would be to say that all of our work as a human rights organization working internationally is based in international human rights law. And on women's rights, you know, in particular, our kind of core document is always the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. And that's not a Western document. That's a convention that's been ratified by most of the countries in the world, where the drafters were countries all over the world. You know, there's nothing Western about it. It belongs to everyone in every country. And I think that if you look at women's rights movements in any country in the world, pick any country, and there's a women's rights movement, and their demands are remarkably similar. Women want to have freedom, to be free from violence, to have access to education, to have access to healthcare, to have access to dignified work on an equal basis with men. They want equity. They want freedom, you know, and I think that international human rights law is kind of should be the antidote to any sort of arguments about cultural relativism. But I think because of that, you see this backlash against women's rights that we're talking about, you see that playing out in some of these international spaces like the UN, where I think there's an effort by some countries to kind of wind back international law, like the Convention on Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, because it is so clear, it lays out the ground rules so clearly and makes it so clear that gender equality is an obligation of every country in the world. And so, you know, there's definitely efforts by quite a few countries to kind of reframe things and talk about the family and talk about tradition and whatever, and try to bring that kind of language into these international law spaces. And one of the things that's really concerning is that, you know, the US obviously has a lot of power in those spaces. You know, it's a huge and very, very wealthy country. It funds a huge proportion of the budget of the United Nations. It's a permanent member of the Security Council. And so to have the US being one of the countries that's now sort of trying to like undermine these rights of women that have been accepted for decades is very, very disturbing. You know, and so it's not just the US itself playing a harmful role, it's also the way that the US doing that emboldens other countries that, you know, maybe also think that women's rights has gone a bit too far and they don't really believe in equality, but they didn't feel comfortable saying that a year ago and now they do.
I think it speaks volumes that Saudi Arabia has ratified CEDAW, although with an exception where it conflicts with their version of Islamic law, but the US never ratified it. we still have never ratified that one, nor the Convention of the Rights of the Child. But anyway, yeah, we're talking about how good it would be for gender apartheid to be part of the Rome Statute, right? But then at the same time, there is this retreat from multilateralism and international law, which is harming everything.
I mean, it's interesting. I was looking at something the other day about, I was writing something, and I wanted to say, you know, there's like increasing levels of conflict around the world, and that makes it more important for us to be talking about the impact that conflict has, the gendered impact conflict has on women and girls. And so I looked up, you know, the research that actually has been done on what the levels of conflict have been at different eras in the world. And sure enough, I mean, we're at a level of conflict which is higher than any that the world has seen since the post-World War II period. So that's very disturbing indeed. And I think one of the things that we should think about in that context is the research that tells us that if you want to reach a peace agreement in a peace negotiation, and if you want that agreement to be implemented, one of the effective things you can do is actually have women as full participants in that process. And of course, the reason that women should be full participants is not just because it's going to lead to a better outcome, but also because they're 50% of the population and it's their right to be there. But there's also an argument for it actually helping to bring peace, which the world could certainly use a bit more of at the moment.
I agree. And there was an excellent article. I can't remember which UN, but it was UN Femme. Oh my God.
UN Women.
UN, okay, yeah.
So it used to be UNIFEM. They changed their name.
Like, why do I think it's, okay, so they changed their name. So UN Women published a recent report about the lack of women participating in these peace treaties and how that was actually leading to instability and not a stable peace. And actually, the other really terrible issue when we're thinking about, okay, there's rising conflict around the world, but this rising conflict includes a lot of atrocities, a lot of war crimes, including rape as a deliberate tactic of war. And now this has been going on throughout history, right? And even last century in Rwanda and the Balkans, and October 7th, the Hamas attack on Israel had sexual violence and rape, and M23 in the DRC and Sudan. And then we tend to sweep it under the carpet a lot of times because we want to have this sustaining peace. And so we want to bring people together, and then the offenders, they do not get sentenced. And it is, sometimes they do, but I'm saying it is not generally the rule, and it keeps happening.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I would say about that is, you know, there's been more discussion about conflict-related sexual violence in maybe the last 10 or 15 years. I think there have been some efforts to really kind of raise the visibility of this issue and talk about what prevention and assistance to survivors and accountability should look like in that context. But I'm not sure that any of that's been terribly effective so far. And we know that as we have more conflicts and more intense conflicts, there's a high risk in any conflict that sexual violence is going to be part of what happens when you have that kind of level of violence and breakdown of law and order. You know, and I think one of the things we've become a little bit more aware of in recent years is that while the vast majority of victims of conflict-related sexual violence are women and girls, it's also affecting men and boys. You mentioned October 7th, but there's also been some really horrifying information coming out about abuses against Palestinians in Israeli prisons since October 7th during the assault that's happening now in Palestine, and many of the victims of those acts of sexual violence have been men. We have a ton more work to do on trying to really have meaningful strategies to hopefully stop conflict-related sexual violence from happening at all, and at least when it happens, to make sure that people can get the help and support that they need and have a hope for justice someday. And I guess one of the things, it's interesting, the UN committee that's responsible for the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women is writing a new set of guidance right now on women and conflict. And one of the things that they're talking about, which is something that our team has been thinking about too, is how it's it's incredibly important for us to talk about conflict-related sexual violence, but it's also incredibly important for us to remember that that's not the only way that conflict harms women and girls, that there's actually a whole range of different ways in which women and girls experience conflict differently than men and boys and people of other genders, that, you know, it's things like losing access to livelihoods, caregiving responsibilities increasing often enormously, barriers to education, which girls face in different ways than boys do and often face sooner and more seriously. Child marriage, which is often driven by girls being out of school, which can definitely be a consequence of a conflict or a crisis. You know, along with the caregiving often comes, you know, sort of women and girls taking the lead and trying to access food and water, and they can face all kinds of barriers doing that. Losing access to land, like women are much less likely in many places to have a land title or a secure sort of ability to maintain their access to land. And that can mean that they're afraid to flee in situations where they really need to. And if they do flee, they may not be able to get back the land that they were living on or perhaps farming. Women and girls, when they are displaced, face all kinds of gendered impacts that in the experience of being displaced, ranging from, you know, sort of dangerous journeys to the latrines and refugee camps where, you know, they might be sort of at risk of sexual violence when they're going to try and use the toilet at night, to you know, asylum procedures that don't recognize domestic violence or don't recognize gendered issues that are kind of like not ready to kind of hear about, you know, sort of gendered reasons that someone's facing persecution and should be receiving asylum. So it's a huge kind of set of issues, and conflict-related sexual violence is definitely one of them, but it's just one of a very long list.
You're absolutely right. Thanks for pointing that out. When we are talking about developing a country, developing any economy, right, the data is pretty clear that the best thing that you can do is educate young girls. If you want a healthy, growing economy, a prosperous country, educate your young girls. And we are actually, around the world, we're backsliding on that. I went into this rabbit hole, Heather. I didn't know what a trad wife was. And a friend mentioned it, and I thought, no. Then I read about it. They're targeting the younger generation and saying, you know what? You don't even have to study. Your purpose is to marry a man and focus on your man and the children that you will have with this man and blah, blah, blah. And that means you have economic dependence. And that means you're not as well educated. And oh my gosh, I am really, really appalled and quite frightened about this.
Yeah. Not all women are feminists. It's interesting. Mona Al-Tahawi, you must know her work. I think she calls them the foot soldiers of the patriarchy. Women who sort of work to uphold the patriarchy. It's interesting. We've been having a discussion with some colleagues because, you know, there'll be a new process to choose a new Secretary General of the United Nations coming up. In 80 years, we've had zero women, over 80 years now, zero women in that job ever. Mm. And so obviously we think it's important that there should be a woman next time. And we're talking about the fact that We don't want a woman. We want a feminist woman.
Yeah. I want PM Mia Motley. That's who I want.
I don't know if she's running, but,
I think she would be great. But you're right. It's not just any woman. It's what are her policies as well? Because, not all women are feminists, as you said. And also, you could be a feminist but have be racist, even though that means you're not supporting all the women of a different race. And so, so you're right. It's the particular woman. But I agree. We haven't had a woman. And, you know, women leaders, okay, not all of them are great. Just like you're not always going to get great male leaders, for instance. But women have been, by and large, good leaders. During the pandemic, when you looked at the female leaders, they had compassion. They were the most communicative leaders because we like to have consensus usually. We are the peacemakers, right? We're the peacemakers in the family. It is a gendered norm, but it kind of rings true. Again, it's a stereotype. We are more willing to listen, to come to the table, and to gain consensus, which makes us good leaders. Again, big stereotype. But in any case, I'm just saying I very much agree with you. I would like a female secretary general if it's the right one. And there are plenty of good contenders, so I don't really see why they would.
Yeah, no shortage of women out there who would be extraordinary at that job. So we just need one.
That's right, we just need one. But I did want to go to another topic. So anytime that we focus on this is targeting women, it always also targets other people, but predominantly women. So a horrifying tactic of acid attacks occurs, and it's in Pakistan, it's in Colombia, and it ruins women's lives. And it's a very gendered crime because it's usually men that are either rejected by a woman or are jealous, or it's their little puny egos out of control. And then it's also in places where acid is accessible, right? And so that's really what the government should focus on, apart from other things, but making this horrible thing inaccessible. But again, it's something that's horrifying, and it is targeted primarily at women.
Yeah, acid attacks are a particularly horrifying form of violence against women or gender-based violence. I think it'd be very hard to point to a country that really has done a good job of responding to domestic violence, to gender-based violence. And I think it's very easy to point to countries that are doing a terrible job of responding to gender-based violence. And we see in some countries, actually, that they're going backwards really quickly. A colleague of mine who's in Argentina has been looking at how the Milei government there has slashed the vast majority of funding that used to be allocated to provide services for women who are experiencing violence in the home. So those services have largely vanished because he specifically went after them. And he's made these really alarming statements about how femicide shouldn't be a crime because it means that you're saying that women's lives are more valuable than men's lives somehow, just completely ignoring the whole kind of context of how that crime was created to recognize that there is a gendered intent in some cases of murder. Argentina is a particularly alarming example, but there are lots of other countries too where we see sort of part of what an authoritarian leader might do is sort of directly attack women's rights and often LGBT rights at the same time. So attacking things like reproductive rights and attacking protections for women and girls who are facing violence and attacking the rights of LGBT people at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, it's connected. If you're attacking women, you're attacking the LGBT community, you're imposing a gender normative system. You wrote an article that piqued my interest. So we're talking about targeted violence against women. And of course, with new technology, oh, guess what? They figured out how to target women. So you talked about increased surveillance and deep fakes, and there's, revenge porn. And the article was predominantly focused on South Korea, but this seems to be also a global phenomenon. Can you tell me a little bit more about the issue in South Korea, but also generally?
Yeah, absolutely. So we call this online gender-based violence, or sometimes tech-enabled gender-based violence. And the reason that we wanted to look at this issue, and we chose to focus on South Korea because South Korea has the unfortunate distinction of being a place where this really kind of emerged as a serious problem. earlier than it did in some other countries, although I would say it's a serious problem in every country now. Part of what was happening in South Korea was that it was very easy and very cheap to buy cameras, like teeny little cameras that were like easy to hide, like in walls and in bathroom stalls and hotel room walls and in devices. And those tiny cameras were being used to film women without their knowledge, including in situations where, you know, they might be naked, they might be engaged in sexual activity, et cetera. And then those images were often posted online without the woman's consent or even her knowledge, you know? So it was, it was a devastating report to research. It was interesting. It was really, really difficult to find women that had had this experience who were willing to talk about it. And I think it's because there was so much shame for a lot of women associated with being the victim of this type of a crime, because the crime consists of you being exposed, you know, of your body being exposed without your consent. And so talking about it is kind of reliving that exposure over and over again. But what I heard from the women I was able to interview was that, you know, it had the most terrible experiences trying to go and get help, you know? So many of them went to the police, which is the obvious thing that you should do when you've been the victim of a crime, which they obviously had been. And then what they found when they went to the police is that they were immediately re-traumatized. So the police would laugh at them. The police would like tell them to go away. The police would say, oh, show me the picture. You know, we heard from like prosecutors and police about like them, police officers and lawyers, like passing these images around their office being like, ha ha ha, look at this, you know, like, when this is actually evidence of a crime and the image is the crime, and there they are sort of, you know,
committing a crime.
Yeah, exactly. Sort of engaging in the same behavior as the perpetrator, you know, and the same with judges. The likelihood of getting through this process and getting to the point where somebody brings charges, somebody takes it to court, you have a conviction, is so slim. And then even if you get that far, the sentences would be so low that they would just have sort of no relation to the amount of harm that the victim had experienced. And we really see this becoming a bigger and bigger issue in every country. And it's been compounded now by the ease with which people can make deep fake images. So you don't even need a camera anymore. You just like, you just take a photo of somebody off of Facebook or something, and then, you know, have your computer alter it to turn it into whatever image you want it to be, which, you know, could be a nude image, could be a pornographic image, whatever it is. And I really think that governments haven't got the faintest idea what to do about this. I mean, I think it really highlighted for me the fact that the laws in pretty much any country you can think of are made by older men. And so their ability to understand like what it's like for younger people who are living online, what the impact of this type of a crime is, and what the, you know, how the technology works to commit this kind of a crime and what kinds of measures could effectively sort of respond to these crimes was just not there at all. And as a result, I mean, you know, we're always in a situation where the law is trying to catch up to, the law is always behind and trying to catch up with changes in technology, changes in society. But this, I think, is an example where that lag is so big and so harmful, you know? And the fact that it's a crime committed mostly against women and girls, again, is another reason why it doesn't rise to where it should on the priority list for legislatures.
Yeah. And particularly when you have a government that decided that women was a political term in healthcare papers, and it was one of the dirty words that should be scrubbed from healthcare. I mean, I, or for instance, why there is no proper menopause and perimenopause medical guidance. It's natural that your bones degrade. Just suffer through it. It's fine. If men went through it, I wonder how much research would be enacted. That's what I want to see. You talked about femicide, and China has a massive demographic problem, right? Because it had the one-child policy and couples preferred the boy. India had a massive femicide issue as well. I mean, it's not just located to these countries, but we have a huge demographic issue in China. And you wrote an article about how this demographic issue is leading to bride trafficking. Can you tell me a little more about that?
Yeah, this is research some years back in Myanmar, although I don't think there's any reason to think that the problem would have ended. We were looking at an area of northern Myanmar, particularly Kachin State, where there's conflict going on. There's been conflict going on there for a very long time, and the conflict has had a really devastating impact on the people living in that area. Many of them are in camps. They've been displaced from their homes. The government was blocking aid getting into the area, which meant that, you know, people had no assistance. They had no sort of help getting food. It was very difficult for people to find a way to get work, to feed themselves, to pay for education, all of that. So it was leaving families in a really, really desperate situation. And a lot of the families, the head of household was often a woman, because sometimes men were off being part of the conflict, or maybe had been killed, or were missing for whatever reason. And so huge pressure on these women to try and keep their families together and, you know, keep their families fed, keep kids in school, and so on. And so this is obviously an amazing environment for human traffickers. You know, no rule of law, desperate situation, porous border. And so what would happen is people would come in the camps and they'd say, you know, I can give you a job, you know, like you can come and work in a clothing store, you can come and work in a restaurant, you can come and work in a hair salon, whatever it is, just over the border in China. And, you know, and lots of people went and did that. And for some of them, there was a legitimate job waiting for them that they had been promised. But for others, what happened after they crossed the border is that they discovered that there was no job waiting for them, and that actually what was happening instead was that they were being sold to a family as a so-called bride. I mean, it was essentially sexual slavery. Like, none of the women that we interviewed had a formal legal marriage ceremony. But what most of them experienced was that the families that had bought them wanted them to produce a baby. So these were families that, you know, often had a son who had been unable to find a bride, because there is a serious gender imbalance in China, in the younger generation. And so this was the way that they decided to find a bride for their son. And you know, they often seem to be more interested in the relationship producing a baby as opposed to actually having a daughter-in-law. Of course, the women that we were able to interview were ones who had escaped and made it back to Myanmar. But you know, many of them had been trapped for years and years before they were able to escape. And many of them had escaped only by leaving children behind, which was devastating for them, of course, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, because it's their child. Okay. So we talked about gender apartheid before and how this would be a positive, even in the situation that international law is a little weakened right now, but still it would have... even if it doesn't have the hard effect, it would have a soft, powerful effect, a shaming effect. So can you tell me more about why it's important to enact gender apartheid and not just limit apartheid to race?
Yeah. So What's powerful about framing something as apartheid is that apartheid is about a system. There are other things that are crimes, like persecution. Persecution is about crimes committed by an individual, but apartheid is a system. You know, it's about a whole government which is built on oppressing a specific group. And the reason that we need apartheid in addition to the other laws that we already have, like the law that makes persecution an international crime, is that we have to capture the totality of the crimes that are being committed against women in these kinds of situations. And Afghan women would say against them. Iranian women would say against them. So we have this really unique opportunity over the next 3.5 years to try to make that happen through this new treaty. And what's important about that process is that every single country in the world has a say in this process, which means that no matter what country you live in, you can be pressuring your government to support this effort, to stand with these activists who are demanding this change to the draft treaty. And you know, if your country already supports this effort, you can try to get them to support it more vocally. If your country opposes this effort, you can try and get them to pipe down a bit at least and not be so vociferous about it. So there's really an opportunity, for sort of everyone to try and be an ally in this effort. And so I would really encourage people to look for the Afghan and Iranian communities in their country and in their communities, see if they're working on this issue, see how to stand with them. There are several different campaigns, several different groups focusing on this issue, some by Afghan women, some by Iranian women, some by mixes of both. There's one website which is really helpful where people can go and find information. It's endgenderapartheid.today. So that's the End Gender Apartheid campaign. I'm sure you'll put a link to it.
I'm going to link to that.
I would just really ask people to read up and learn about it and think about whether there are ways to pitch in. Because as I said, we're seeing, as you've talked about a lot, we're seeing these really frightening rollbacks of women's rights in so many countries, including the United States. And I think it really illustrates how perilous the situation of women's rights is everywhere and how we all really have an interest in fighting back in ways that could actually strengthen the protections of our rights rather than just being aghast as they're dismantled.
Yeah. I agree with you that we need to enact it, particularly at a time when we are losing rights everywhere. You could see the rampant misogyny just even in, well, the fact that we've never had a woman president and just the narrative of female politicians. If you compare them next to men, the use of terminology for women is quite different. So men are passionate, but women are emotional. Men are assertive, but women are aggressive. Men are flexible and women flip-flop. It just goes on and on. I'm so appalled by it and so sick of it. It just keeps continuing.
Yeah. One other thing we should say, we talked about online gender-based violence, but imagine the kind of abuse that women politicians face these days. It's really, really, really intense and very, very gendered. And this kind of online space has become really a space where people are sort of feeling very free to hurl all of their misogyny at prominent women. And I think it's made it a much harder thing to step forward and say, okay, I'm going to run for office, you know, okay, I'd like to be the next president of the United States. You know, I think it's not in anyone's interest to have those be terrible jobs that no sane person would want. And increasingly, I think that is how it feels to some women who have gone into politics, that like the level of abuse that they're facing is unsustainable and frightening. So that's a terrible development as well. And I think also it points again to the need for lawmakers to sort of get to grips with what's the legal framework that we need for this kind of new technology that's come into our lives.
Yeah, and to stop talking about what women politicians are wearing. We don't talk about, oh, look, he's wearing blah, blah, blah. No, but when a woman speaks, it detracts from what she's saying because we're focused on, oh, what suit she's wearing and so forth. And maybe that's deliberate. Deliberate means to divert, deflect, and demean. But what is great is that there is resistance and there's progress happening. Saudi Arabia, a country that still is not very good to women, but there has been progress there. Women are now 34% of the workforce. Women have more rights. They can drive. I believe there was an edict that said women do not have to wear the hijab if they don't want to, but I don't know if that's going to be enforced. This is MBS trying to be all sort of progressive.
Yeah. Well, I want to say something about it, though, is that we also see a lot of countries sort of using sport washing, as we call it, as a way to kind of make themselves look better. And I think Saudi Arabia is a country that has played a role in inventing the concept of sport washing, of sort of, you know, making themselves look good on the international stage. And I want to say also that, yes, there have been those areas in which there's been some progress on women's rights, but the guardianship system, which puts men in charge of making decisions for women, is fully intact. And a lot of the activists who fought for women's rights in Saudi Arabia are in prison right now.
Right, serving like 11-year sentences, right? Wasn't there some fake terrorist charge against a woman activist and she's still serving years in prison?
I'm not sure about that. I don't have details about that specific case, but just to say that, like, you know, we have to look below the surface as well. And as long as activists are in prison, I think we have to be really asking about how much progress has there really been, you know? They've definitely like moved into some roles that where they sound good on women's rights, and there's a big disconnect between how they sound and what's actually happening.
But I wonder if they're trying to clean the image on the international stage and say, oh, no, we're not like that. Okay, well, then release your female prisoners. Get rid of guardianship. Maybe that's the way to do it, to nudge them to go, okay, well, this is where you want to be. Hey, this is how you get there. And then it's also great to see the resistance that's happening. We talked about the resistance of Iranian women and Afghan women, both within the country and outside in the diaspora. And I just think that that's amazing. They're so courageous and so bold and so strong. Women riding motorbikes in Tehran and protesting and supporting other women that are going to these morality clinics. I mean, what bullshit. Sorry. But I first saw it as a post on LinkedIn that you reposted, and it was the Afghan women's soccer team. I am the biggest fan that these so-called Taliban, these criminals, say that women can't play sports. So I am all for the Afghan FIFA team, which is, I think, made up of people in the diaspora. Now, none of them are actually located within Afghanistan because they're not allowed to play sport in Afghanistan.
Yeah, I mean, after the Taliban took over, they all had to flee their country. That's what happened. And they spent years fighting to get FIFA to actually recognize them and allow them to play. And it's only just begun to happen. They shouldn't have had to wait a day. They should have been able to be recognized and be able to play immediately. But they had to fight so long and so hard. It's been really joyous to watch them play now that they've finally gotten that after so much fighting. But yeah, I have another colleague who works full time on trying to pressure sports organizations like FIFA, like the Olympics, to not be a party to sport washing, to really sort of make human rights part of what sport is about and to make ethical decisions about how sporting events are held and how teams are supported and how athletes are protected, all of these issues, you know?
And we should extend it to how the workers that build the stadiums are treated.
Absolutely.
As well, yeah. Considering...
100%. No, that's absolutely part of it. Yeah, no, we spend a lot of... We have colleagues who spend a lot of time documenting heat-related deaths while they were building the FIFA stadium, I think, in Qatar. And
well, that's the thing. A place that oppresses women is going to oppress other people as well. Oppression begets oppression. Freedom begets freedom. We're all in this together, right?
Absolutely.
That's why we want gender apartheid as well. No one's trying to get rid of racial apartheid. We just want to add gendered apartheid. And might I add, and I know that people might say that this would dilute apartheid, but I don't think so. I really don't even think we need anything there at all. If it's one group of people subjugating another group of people systemically trying to destroy them, and the whole system is there for their oppression and destruction, I don't really think we need to define what that group is. We just have to make sure that it fits within that widespread, systemic, intentional, oppressive system.
Yeah, I mean, there'll be a whole negotiation process with states where if this proposal sort of continues to gain ground, the states will negotiate over every word and whatever they come up with, as long as it has the concept and it actually provides protections to women who are in this situation, then it'll be an important step forward.
So we are resisting, right, Heather?
Absolutely. We have no choice and we have to do it together.
We have to do it together. Oh, Heather, thank you so much for your insight and your time today. And all the work that you do.
Thank you. Thanks so much for inviting me.
I hope you have found this podcast insightful and will join us next time as we explore more issues affecting our environment and human rights at home and around the world. For more materials on this issue, please go to our website, thegravity.fm.